Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of December. Do we ever have a story for you the first hour of this show? Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and National Geographic fellow, Paul Salopek, is our guest. Paul is walking all over this planet. He just completed the first leg of a 2,100-mile trek to trace on foot the path of human migration. He began walking in January of 2013. He's currently just crossed the border from Saudi Arabia to Jordan. And 30 million footsteps later, if everything goes all right, he'll complete his Out of Eden walk in Patagonia, Argentina, in 2020. His goal is to experience the world at a pace that our ancestors set when they first migrated across the planet and to explore how our modern lives connect with the geography of the present and the past. He's writing about the experience online, and the cover story of National Geographic for December features him in Our Greatest Journey, One Man, 7 Years, 21,000 Miles, retracing 60,000 years of human migration. Paul is a really adventuresome soul. He has been a foreign correspondent working in Africa, the Balkans, the Middle East, Central Asia, Latin America. His stories have appeared in the Chicago Tribune, National Geographic, Foreign Policy, Conservation Magazine. He has spent most of his career in print journalism and has undertaken long, solo, muscle-powered journeys through the stories that he covered. He canoed for weeks down the Congo River to report on the Congo Civil War. He has clerked at a Chicago gas station for a story on global oil. And he once rode a mule for a whole year through Mexico's Sierra Madre to write a personal meditation about the people and the place. So this is quite a story. And the photos in the magazine, as they always are, but these are particularly striking, as is his beautiful writing. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Paul. We have him on Skype right now from Jordan, and we hope that the line will last. If not, we'll pause and we can reconnect with him. But if you'd like to join the conversation, I hope some of you have seen the magazine. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen.
Oh, Paul, I can't believe what kind of journey you're on. It is just phenomenal, isn't it?
Well, it is personally for me, and I would hope that it is for the readers as well, because it's all of our journey. It's not just mine, and that's, I think, part of the beauty of it.
You started in Africa. You started at the oldest known place where humans lived. Is that where it started?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest archaic Homo sapiens fossil sites that we know of, where the dating is pretty good, and that's about 160,000 years ago. So that seemed like a good symbolic starting line.
You talk about this walking, and you're walking as people used to not have cars. Just the act of traveling through the world at 3 miles an hour is kind of a spiritual experience in a way, isn't it? It certainly leads one to meditate.
Yeah, I think that's a good word to use. I think walking is meditative. I think using our bodies the way they're designed biologically, evolutionarily to be used, taps into some deep level of consciousness that's marrow deep. It's down into our bones. So it's been a real wonderful journey so far. I mean, I have no illusions about the difficulties that I've experienced already and the ones that lie ahead, but it's been a joy.
Not only your personal difficulties, but as you can see in the magazine this month and also on your blog, the difficulties of living for so many people on this planet, life is really tough, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's, one of the true lines of this complicated story that I'm trying to string together across 7 years is the fact that we have this illusion in the developed world, in the global north, as some people call it, that the world's getting smaller because of the internet. And of course it is. You know, it's very easy now to connect with anybody around the world. But when you experience the world with your body, you see just how vastly different human experience is. And of course, the Horn of Africa is one of the most unstable and destitute corners of the world. So there were days where the lives of the people around me were quite sobering to see.
Mm-hmm. Where were you? I was struck by this passage. I can't remember exactly where you were. You were crossing a desert, and it was really hot, and you had walked 20 miles, which must have been excruciatingly difficult, and you came across some people who offered you a strange sort of water and, I believe, some berries.
Yeah, these are the main ethnic group whose territory I walked through are called the Afar, and they're pastoral nomadists. They move sheep and goats and occasionally, you know, cattle and camels across one of the most arid, challenging landscapes on earth. So Alema Hassan and I were walking to this site of the oldest stone tools in the world, about 2.6 million years old, and we ran out of water. We basically were starting to exchange glances as we each got thirstier and thirstier. And then we heard the very distant sound of bleating of goats, and that made us very happy because where there are goats, there are people. And then there was a small band of these pastoralists camped on a hilltop, and an old woman offered us very alkaline well water that was almost soapy. It was so alkaline. Mm. And some withered berries she'd harvested from a tree.
She must have been pretty struck seeing you. Who the heck is this guy, huh?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's another thing about this experience that's interesting. As a foreign correspondent, you know, what it's highlighted, I've been working in Africa for more than a decade. I've worked in all these other places that you mentioned in the intro, is that we are insulated by our money. I mean, and it's this is not an accusation or a criticism. You have to have money to cover these complicated international stories. You have to get there to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're on deadlines, so you don't have the luxury of time of mosing your way through these big issues, you know, global warming, poverty, conflict, environmental issues. But by getting out of a car, by getting out of planes, getting out of these mechanical conveyances and getting down at foot level and eye level, literally, with the people who inhabit these landscapes, it's been, I think, good for my storytelling. I think it allows me to have a deeper understanding of the people that I'm writing about and the issues that affect their lives.
Well, it seems to me that you're going to have an understanding of those very issues, global warming, conflict in the world, like nobody else. Nobody does what you're doing.
Yeah, well, we used to, right? This is another thing I keep reminding readers, is that this is nothing new. In fact, it's the oldest form of storytelling known. I'm actually borrowing not a page, but a gigantic volume from our storytelling past. In West Africa, they were called griots, wandering storytellers who played musical instruments and walked from village to village reciting clan histories, reciting poetry. In the Western canon, we know them as, you know, bards, Greek bards who did the same. So walking and telling stories goes way back to the first campfires that we gathered around as hunter-gatherers way back in the Pleistocene. And we would describe what we saw when we went out hunting that day. We started exchanging stories. So this is the oldest form of storytelling around. But what's really cool, Kathleen, is I'm trying to couple it with high technology.
Yes. And there's a striking picture in the National Geographic talk about people who are living poorly, but they're all holding their cell phones to the sky. This is in, where is this? We're trying to make contact with relatives who have left the area. It's on the other side of Somalia. Is that where it is?
Yeah, it's a country called Djibouti, a very small country next to Somalia. And what they're doing is, it was a very striking site. The photographer, John Stanmeyer, found them. They would go out in the evening when police would not harass them because they're, most of them, undocumented migrants, people without papers, leaving Africa to go to the Middle East to look for work. And they would use their cell phones to capture cell signals from neighboring Somalia because they're cheaper to call relatives in the U.S. and Canada. And often I heard cities in the Midwest where there are large, you know, a large Somali diaspora, talk to them to get guidance. And it was very moving because it struck me how we're still using social connections to move across the world, even 600 centuries after leaving Africa.
I was struck, Paul, you must be struck by so many of the things that we don't even notice every single day, but I was struck by your story about looking at people's feet and what they were wearing on their feet. You probably have had to pay careful attention to that because your feet are going to take you thousands and thousands of miles. In many parts of the world, people wore the same plastic sandal.
Yeah, in particular in the Horn of Africa, and especially so in Ethiopia, there's a very famous footwear there for people who travel through that part of Africa. They're these plastic or rubber sandals that are just kind of injected, molded plastic in a limited number of colors and in one style, these kind of buckle-on things that you can twist and bend in your hand, and they cost, you know, a buck or two. And, you know, talk about appropriate technology, right? I mean, these are cool on the feet for desert travel, and when they break, you can mend them by melting the plastic back together in a campfire.
Goodness.
And pretty much everybody wears them, men, women, and children. And I've struck by the simplicity and artfulness of that design, which was compelled by necessity, right? These are very poor people. And then to contrast that with the fashion fetish, again, in more affluent societies, where there's just a mind-numbing variety of footwear, and there's this whole subculture built around footwear.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's one of the interesting contrasts early on in the walk.
You write about, we were doing a show on albinos in Tanzania yesterday, and for 2 days in a row I've read about Tanzania, which life works like that. But you were discussing the fact that there are still hunter-gatherer societies in Tanzania. Did you meet any of those people, and are they to be found elsewhere in your travels?
Yes. No, I cite them. I cite the scientific literature on them, but I did not walk through Tanzania. That was a little further south on the Rift Valley. I could very well have, though. I mean, you know, my choice of a departure point, again, was largely symbolic. But those people, the Hadza, are one of the last hunter-gatherer groups left in Africa. There are others, as you probably are aware of, in places like the Amazon. And what scientists have done is strap them with GPS devices and told them, go out and do your stuff, your ordinary hunting and gathering. And the data they've gotten back is just compelling, because what it does is it quantifies for us in some measurable way how quickly we may have spread across the world, or how much we walked anyway when we were hunter-gatherers, which is more than 90% of our history. And what they found was that men walk on average, about 7 miles a day or so, 7 to 10. And women maybe a little less, gathering food products or plant products. So what I keep reminding readers who keep obsessing about the extremity or the physical extremity of this walk is that actually what I'm doing is very old and very normal. Walking from New York to L.A. every year is pretty much how much these hunter-gatherers walk every year of their adult lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more or less what I'm walking in a year. That's normal. The inactivity that so, you know, characterizes modern industrial life is what's abnormal. That's extreme.
At what point did you start noticing, and you wrote about this in the New York Times, what you call a car brain? Certainly automobiles have changed the way that we get around and changed our landscape so dramatically. What do you mean by car brain, and where did you first encounter it?
I think it took me It had to wait till I got out of Africa, because walking through that particular neighborhood of Africa, again, the Rift Valley of Ethiopia, is one of the last inhabited corners of the world where car ownership is really, really low. I think the World Bank figures, as I recall, are on the order of 2 or 3 cars per 1,000 people. But then as I took a boat across the Red Sea and entered Saudi Arabia, which is a very affluent country, there were lots of contrasts going from Djibouti and Ethiopia to Saudi Arabia, as you might imagine. But one of the biggest that struck me was just how subjugated the developed world is to the car tire. It changed not just the lay of the land. It wasn't just a matter of the land now being parsed by roads designed for machines, which wasn't the case in Africa, where most people still walk. It changes our heads. I think it's rewired our brains in fundamental ways that we've just sort of forgotten how changed it is. And the argument that I made in that piece that you just cited is that I think it's actually a bigger change even than what the information revolution is causing in our minds with the internet.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Paul is joining us by satellite. Skype? It's Skype from Jordan. He's just crossed into Jordan from Saudi Arabia. It's a phenomenal journey, as you can tell just by listening to him. And the way he's documenting it is very much 2013. He has a blog. He has striking pictures that you can find on National Geographic. You can look at the magazine for the month of December and see some of the photographs. He is documenting this entire trip, and just imagine all that he's going to know after 7 years of walking across this planet. He started in January of this year, and he's retracing the pathways of the first anatomically modern humans who colonized the planet 60,000 years ago. His finish line will be in Tierra del Fuego in South America. And this is a journey that will take him 7 continuous years. It's going to span 21,000 miles. He's gone about 1,700 miles to date. So he's writing these dispatches that are so interesting. And they're on human evolution and conflict, nomadism, the car, climate change, using deep history as a mirror for current events. He writes, and we'll start taking your calls momentarily, if you'd like to chat with him. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To take you to where he has been, we have a little bit of sound during the course of this hour. He mentioned Djibouti and the people who are standing with their cell phones trying to reach people who are in the States and many of them in the Midwest. He writes this, and then we'll hear the sound. This is from February 19, 2013, day 41 of his journey, mile 200. We just washed ourselves at a camel watering hole. A canyon of black stone led us down into the coastal plain. The trails had been used for centuries by the slave and salt traders. That morning, two ground-hugging American fighter jets tore apart the sky with the sound of ripping bedsheets. They were from a base in Djibouti. We watched them standing atop the lowest seam of the Rift Valley. Arabia was pulling away from Africa beneath our feet at the rate of 16 millimeters a year. That made everything else seem irrelevant. This is the sound of two men singing in Djibouti. Paul Salopak is our guest. You can see his journey online, National Geographic, or please get the December issue of the magazine. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our first caller is Linda in Egg Harbor. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just curious whether your guest was planning to include in his trajectory around the world all of the megalithic sites that seem to connect by pattern all of the various cultures of the world at a time when they could not have known about each other. For example, the pyramids in Giza, the Mayan temples in Central America, Machu Picchu, Stonehenge, things along those lines. Just curious whether he was planning to include those. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
Yeah, good question, Linda. The people that I'm following are actually from a diaspora that goes way back, long before the building of those sites that you mentioned. I'm following people who were essentially hunter-gatherers. But that doesn't mean I won't be stopping at these archaeological sites. I mean, there are megalithic sites in Yemen that I'd hope to get to but could not walk through for security reasons. But the human impulse to build gigantic structures is also something that's very human. It's something I think that comes with civilization, you know, many, many centuries, millenniums, in fact, after we first spread across the world. I'm looking forward to visiting a very amazing one in Turkey that predates all of the structures that you just mentioned by thousands of years and is remarkable for the fact that it appears to have been built by hunter-gatherers, not one of these big high-quality. So it's pretty amazing.
You talk about, and this must fill you with a sense of time that many people don't have, you write that 93% of all the human beings who ever existed on Earth have vanished before us. Most of humanity is gone.
Yeah, I think that's a realization that came to me from the walk, from slowing down. It's very easy to forget that when you're speeding around the world, collecting and disseminating information at the speed of light through the internet, through modern technology. So, this very notion of forgetting, I mentioned that the walk is about remembering, but it's also about forgetting that, if we actually knew how much heartbreak, how much triumph lay littered along the trail of our long journey behind us, we might just stop walking. We may end up just sitting down. And I get a very strong sense that I was walking in the footpaths of many, many, many millions of people who led extraordinary lives that we know nothing about.
Mm-hmm. And there are some dramatic pictures. You were crossing a lava field in Djibouti, and you found bodies, people who were trying to get to where there might be work who were crossing these fields. It's kind of gruesome, but it's also an indication of what people go through in order to be able to live.
Well, Kathleen, it raises the question of how much has changed, right? Mm-hmm. After 60 or 70,000 years. Mm-hmm. Certainly moving across the world incrementally. And what I have to remind readers, too, is that I don't want to give them the impression that our ancestors marched out of Africa with some destination in mind. Destinations hadn't even been invented.
Mm-hmm.
They were pushed by climate factors and hunger and population pressure, and they sort of moved sideways and backwards and in all directions. But, yes, I think finding dead migrants, the bodies, the unburied bodies of dead men and women who had walked these same trails, the same landscape as early as humans did to leave Africa,
mm-hmm.
was a haunting reminder of just how circular history is. It brings back the quote by Faulkner, that the past is not dead, it's not even past. It's circular. We keep repeating the stories of our travails, of our heartaches, and again, our joys over and over again.
Let's go to Allison in Racine. Hello, Allison.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You were touching on actually what my question was. We subscribe to National Geographic, and we're very interested in your incredible journey and article. And I also like to share the magazine with my son. He's 5, but the picture of the corpse that you encountered, or one of the corpses you encountered in Djibouti, I don't think I'll be able to share with him. And I guess I'm just wondering how you determined or decided which pictures to include, because, of course, the magazine is known for the stories they convey also through their photos. And I'm curious as to how you decided which photos to include.
It's a really important question that will be recurring throughout the walk. What do you show? What don't you show? And, as a journalist, that's a decision that we have to make every single day. And as somebody who's covered an awful lot of conflict, I've covered all the wars in Africa since the late 90s. I've been to Iraq. I've been to Afghanistan. It becomes a question of withholding. And do you damage to the truth by withholding imagery, particularly imagery? That seems to strike people. And again, I remind you, I'm not a photographer or a professional one. I take pictures for our social media and our website. But that amazing, haunting and heartbreaking image was taken by National Geographic photographer John Stanmeyer. I think the editors chose to include that to show precisely the level of suffering that occurs along this stretch of the Ethiopian desert or the Djiboutian desert. And I approved of it. I think I wanted that in there, knowing how upsetting it is. I don't think we should sugarcoat how hard life is for large numbers of people.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very important picture to have in the magazine. Very important. It says so much. That picture says so much, doesn't it?
Well, I think it also puts my own puny project in perspective. I mean, after all, look, I'm walking in pursuit of ideas, which is pretty trivial compared to what Africans are laying on the line when they walk that desert. Mm-hmm. They are literally laying their lives on the line to make their lives better. They're selling every possession they have, and they're walking across a very harsh, unknown landscape towards an unknown future. And I think that to honor their struggle, that image deserved to be in there.
Well, but you're giving us their story as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't know that.
And, you know, I think something I would like to bring up now, Kathleen, or tell me if there are other callers I can
bring. Oh, there are, but go ahead, bring it up, and we'll go back to callers.
You know, so far we've been talking about National Geographic Magazine and National Geographic website, and that's all in good, but I think what I'd love to make clear is that a big, big part of this idea is experimental storytelling. So we have, if you will, conventional storytelling in the print magazine or on the website or blogs. But what's really interesting to me and very important and close to my heart is trying new forms of storytelling using cutting-edge technology and cutting-edge ideas for this very old form of ambulatory journalism, of walking journalism. And we have another website that's www.outofedenwalk.com, where we're every 100 miles, we're taking a snapshot of the surface of the earth, taking ambient sound, filming the surface of the earth and interviewing the nearest human being. And I'm going to do this all the way across the world, across
wow.
three continents, so that there'll be a little beads along the pathway of our ancestors that will be kind of a snapshot of what life was like on our planet at the turn of this millennium. And we're also playing with social media. We're taking snapshots of Twitter feeds every 100 miles to show how the digital conversation is very different from the world that I'm seeing at boot level. So, for example, with those tragic migrants in the African desert, I might write a story that comes out of my heart about how wrenching it was. Mm. But the Twitter talk above it may be about people trying to find hotel rooms in the city nearby.
Oh my goodness!
And the disconnect between the physical world and the digital world is a fascinating one to me, and we're playing with these concepts as well.
I don't know how you take all of that into your being, because you've got so much going on at the same time, all of the history that is informing this walk and the vast differences in the way people live and in money and technology. It's huge, isn't it? It must be hard to incorporate all of that.
It is, but, you know, what's really amazing about living in the day that we live on the planet that we live on is that the technology is allowing us for the first time ever to begin peeling that complicated onion. And again, I go back to, you know, my head and my heart and my feet are immersed in the dusty plains of some African outback, for example. But I have the capability with a satellite phone call and a satellite connection to a laptop to plug into this highly abstract dialogue that's going on above my head in social media. Never before have we been able to slice down into human experience this way. And this project, this walk, is all about slicing down through those layers.
Thanks, Allison, for your call. Jim in Menominee, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just read your article a couple of nights ago, and it's very obvious that you are an award-winning journalist. Your pursuit of ideas theme is just beautifully put throughout the article. My question is that with the complexity and the distance that you're traveling, how are you handling the logistics of planning your route, the guides that are helping you along, especially when we're looking, you know, several years down the line for the rest of your travels here?
Yeah, another great question, Jim. You know, it's impossible to plan too far ahead on a journey like this because the world changes too quickly, and it would be a waste of my energy and time to be making really granular plans for Central Asia right now, because the countries that I'll be walking through may have different leaders or they might have different policies. They may not even issue me a visa. So the walk has been another thing to me in my journalism, going from being a conventional reporter who travels around quickly and files quickly. It really anchors me in the moment. I don't have the luxury of planning, you know, more than a week or two ahead, because there's just, when you're moving at 3 miles an hour, too much can change. You're not zapping there in an hour or a couple hours in a car. It's taking you days, if not weeks, to reach your next story. And so I'm walking literally from story to story. And the best stories are the ones that I don't even know are there. They're waiting for me. And then I stop. So short answer to your question is I can't. This, what I've told my media partners, National Geographic included, is that this is an exercise in being comfortable with uncertainty, just as our ancestors had to be when they moved across the earth, facing these enormously more difficult obstacles, such as glaciers and gigantic predators that would eat them. They had to adapt in the moment. I have to do the same to a lesser degree, nothing quite as dramatic as that. If I run into a border that's closed, it's up to me in real time to make a decision how to get around that.
What if you run into a lion?
Well, I think it'll be a while before that happens, unless one gets out of a zoo, because I've left Africa.
So
coming down the west coast of the U.S., and there are mountain lions up there that are used to people, so they're probably more dangerous than African lions.
Right. Do you feel that you ever, I don't even know if you have a home because you've been a foreign correspondent for so long, do you really feel at this point in your life that home is wherever you are?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too, about sort of the conception of the project. I think one of the reasons I'm doing this, or I chose to do it and can do it, is precisely because of that. You know, I was born in the U.S., but raised in a different culture, a radically different one. I was raised in a semi-rural area of central Mexico, basically raised in the 19th century, largely. My friends, my playmates, their fathers were still plowing fields with mules, and some of them were using kerosene lanterns for lighting. So I'm carrying some pretty odd stuff around in my head that was very formative, that has actually allowed me to adapt to the practical challenges of this walk in a way that maybe somebody who had, for example, been a conventional foreign correspondent who's used to like all the artifacts of a modern newsroom might find very difficult or very challenging. I don't feel like I need a really solid point on the map as a place to call home. I like to think, and some of this is also rationalization doubtless, that my home is between my ears, and I choose to keep it pretty well furnished, which means having big windows to look out on and learning as much as I can about the people around me. So I'm very comfortable with moving across borders, cultural, linguistic, physical ones.
Yeah, I imagine your home is well furnished. Let's welcome more phone calls. We're speaking this hour with a man who is started last January, and he will finish his journey 7 years from now. He is walking across the planet. He is going to have a 30 million footstep journey. He started in Africa's Rift Valley, the cradle of civilization. His goal is to experience the world at the pace that our ancestors set when they first migrated across Earth, and to explore all that there is along the way, with the past informing what he is seeing now. It's really a phenomenal, phenomenal journey. You can find the first part of the journey in National Geographic's December issue, Our Greatest Journey. But as you heard Paul say, he's doing all kinds of things. He's doing Twitter, and he's doing a blog with pictures and documenting every 100 miles. So there is another website that you'll want to be sure to see, and that's outofedenwalk.com. We'll put these on our Facebook page as well, so you can see all of this, outofedenwalk.com. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Paul Salopek is a National Geographic Fellow, and he has been a foreign journalist. He's worked in Africa for a number of years, and in the Balkans, the Middle East, Central Asia, Latin America, has written for a variety of publications, and has gone on nothing quite this large, but has been on adventure assignments and dangerous assignments for publications for some time now. So we welcome more of your phone calls. Let me give you again how to reach us. He is joining us by Skype from Jordan, where he's just crossed the border by foot from Saudi Arabia. 800-486-8655 is the number. talk@WPR.org is the email address, or leave messages for us or for him, too, which he'd love to read. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is some of the sound that you can hear on the variety of websites that Paul has put together. This is from April of 2013, day 9, 100 and mile 800 this is. The ship's crewmen were aware of their low status as livestock carriers and that other sailors mocked their butcher's boat smell. They wore, many of them, in the presence of a stranger, the blank faces of pariahs, of untouchables. They didn't want to know their cargo. This was understandable. They were just doing their jobs. They were feeding people. They ignored the eyes of thousands of animals following their every move on deck. This was in the Red Sea, livestock aboard the MV Abu Yasser II. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Tom in La Crosse, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if you could describe your overall plan for the route. Is it linear? Are you running it in segments? Are you going to take the different major routes out of the Rift Valley area? Are you going into Europe? I assume if you're crossing into Jordan, you may go across southern Asia, the Indonesian archipelago, and Australia, the Bering Strait, and so on. And one other thing, are you circumventing large industrialized and developed areas and trying to follow more rural route, or are you just going to follow the main routes that we believe these people took?
Yeah, no, it'll probably be the latter. It's going to be wherever the scientists tell me we likely spread, I will walk through what's there. And that includes the highly industrialized coast of China, where I'll probably end up picking up a few kilos of carbon in my lungs from all the traffic. Mm. But, you know, I think that's part of the story, right? This is not a recreation of a Stone Age spread across the world. I'm not out hunting wild game. The whole idea is to look at the modern world through older eyes. So I welcome walking through large informal settlements, slums in India, as much as over, you know, pristine mountain landscapes in the Himalayas. I think that's all part of the package on this journey.
Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. John on Facebook asks this, Paul, what kind of food do you take and how much water is carried during your extended walking segments? You must have a strong sense of place as you see firsthand the landscape, the people, and their interaction with their natural resources.
Yeah, you know, I carry as little as possible, to be frank. It's no fun, as anybody who's backpacks knows, to carry any weight. So I go really ultra light. And up till now, have had the luxury of having animals carry my weight for me. Through the Horn of Africa and then through Arabia, I've had camels do the bulk of the carrying. And that's been an interesting experience, actually, walking with large animals that weigh 1,000 pounds that you get to know as companions. Walking with camels has taught me a lot about the landscape because I have to look out for them just as they're looking out for me by carrying my weight, albeit unwittingly or unwillingly. I mean, they've been dragooned to this exercise. But looking for forage, looking for wells to give them water has, I think, given me a deeper understanding and connection to the land, which is, you know, answers the second part of your question. Moving on foot across the land for extended periods of time, as anybody who does these really long hikes on these transcontinental trails in the U.S. can probably attest, gives you a great confidence in the capability of your body, and you get to know your limits as well. So it feels, again, very natural. There's nothing scary about it. You wake up in the morning, you have a glass of chai, you might eat whatever local food's available. You know, in Arabia, that's a lot of roast sheep with rice. And you just set off on a compass bearing and you head for the nearest waterhole. And there's something really old and very familiar about this. I feel like I'm walking well-trod grooves, not just through the landscape, but through my own neurons. It feels very, very natural.
Mm. Did you grow attached to the camels? I know there's a picture in the magazine. Is it you petting the camel?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a semi-agricultural society where there wasn't much sentimentality attached to animals the way, you know, people in, say, in the U.S. have them as pets. They're, mm-hmm. they're partners in work. There's respect, but they're partners in work. But I've got to admit, Kathleen, I developed an especial attachment to camels on this first year. They're very loyal animals, and they've got great, dry senses of humor.
You know, you got to tell me about that. How do they have senses of humor?
Well, they play tricks on you. One of the younger camels like to sneak up behind you in sand, and, of course, their feet are padded so they can walk very quietly and take your entire head inside of his jaws. He kind of open his mouth and take my cranium inside of it, but not squeeze, of course. I wouldn't be here talking to you otherwise.
Right.
I'll give you one other quick example. One of the camels I walked with in Saudi Arabia, his name was Fadis, and he was a big guy, kind of a grumpy guy, a bit of a slob, and he would develop a capability to let you know that you were taking him across rocky terrain. Camels don't like walking across rocks. And after a few hundred meters, I would be leading him on a rope. He would come up behind me and very gently take my shoulder in his mouth and just apply a little bit of pressure just to signal that he would prefer that we go on a softer route.
Those are great stories. All right, let's go to Ray in Brownsville. Hi, Ray.
Hey, I just wanted to ask him as to how he obtained a visa to go through Saudi Arabia, because I know I've lived in Saudi Arabia, and it's very difficult to get a visa.
I can't hear you very well. Did you say Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia, Ray?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I heard Kathleen. He's asking how on earth did I get permission to walk through Saudi Arabia, which, as Ray points out quite correctly, is a difficult place to go to unless you're invited there to work. You know, largely in the oil industry. It's a country that is only now taking very tentative small steps to open itself up to tourism, and it's very controlled. You know, I applied to Saudi Arabia when I was trying to decide, keep my options open about how to walk out of Africa and into the Middle East, and I didn't have high hopes that I would be granted permission to walk through Saudi. But lo and behold, I was given permission. It took months of waiting, and it turns out that there, you know, they were people within the Saudi government who were very interested in the walk. They were intrigued by the idea, and they're very forward-looking folks. They're also thinking about how their society relates to history. And in this case, it was the Saudi Commission on Tourism and Antiquities that acted sort of as my sponsor, who basically smoothed the pathway for me to get through all the bureaucracy to come in. And it still astonishes me when I look back on it. I mean, I just did it. I just walked out of Saudi Arabia. That I was able to walk all the way through the Hejaz, this fabled corner of Arabia that has been closed to outsiders for centuries. As Ray points out, it's a sacred landscape. It's the home of the two holiest cities in Islam. That I was given permission to roam pretty much anywhere I wanted through this landscape, and I think I might be the first guy to do it since Lawrence was there in 1918.
Goodness.
During the Arab
Goodness. And you write about it while roaming the old pilgrim roads in Saudi Arabia. You've written you came to understand how the journey to Mecca, the Hajj, was perhaps as important as reaching Islam's holiest city, the journey itself.
Yeah, that was a remarkable and unexpected discovery for me in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, again, is only just beginning to develop and preserve its cultural heritage. And I think I wasn't prepared to stumble across these ancient pilgrim roads through the deserts of the Hejaz, which are big grooves worn into the landscape by millions of pilgrims' feet and camel caravans over the centuries that are lined by rocks and in some cases paved in some areas by stones. And there are ruins of Ottoman forts along the way and you know, wells that are still usable that are hundreds of years old. There are these amazing linear artifacts that the whole world basically doesn't know exists. and it was a great privilege to walk along them. And walking along them puts you in a meditative state that I think was an important aspect of going on pilgrimage and still is for people who do this today. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ray, for your call. Deborah in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I grew up watching National Geographic. I think I saw every single National Geographic special that was ever on. But, you know, I was curious about what your childhood was like. But I wrote this poem, and it's 30 seconds long. I wrote it on November 30th. Would you like to hear it?
Sure, Deborah.
I've been thinking about the world we live in, a tiny planet that keeps on spinning. And as it spins, it circles the sun. It keeps on spinning. It's never done. And because we're here, we spin along, our lives another circle song. We're born, we grow, and as we roam, our circle always brings us back home. Our life is a circle within another on a sphere called Earth, which is everyone's mother. We are we circle the sun, which keeps us alive, and the hope called love is how we survive.
Thank you, Deborah. Very nice. That was very nice.
It was very nice. Yeah, I think it harkens at the one of the central facts that you're probably pointing out with your poetry, that all quest stories generally end with some realization that brings you back home, even if it's a psychic or emotional home. So thanks for your poem.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that you're going to be looking at things like climate change on this journey. Is that an active part of the journey? Are you meeting with scientists at all? Are you looking at what's happening with ice? Are you looking at heat and how much hotter it's become? How will you take that on?
That story will evolve organically as I move through landscapes that are, you know, acutely impacted by climate change. So the main story that I've written so far along my first year was just how it's an unusual one. And again, one I don't think I would have gotten had I been speeding through the area in a car or plane, is how, of all things, Somali pirates have impacted climate science because they've scared away all the oceanographic research vessels that used to gather very important information off the coast of out of that part of Africa, including weather patterns that predict rainfall in southern Asia, which is a huge breadbasket for humanity. So those are the really sideways or diagonal connections between stories that I love about this walk, connecting things that are very unexpected, in this case piracy, which everybody only associates with like a Tom Hanks movie, with climate science. And these are the strange connections that you can put together when you slow down.
I'm amazed you know that there's a Tom Hanks movie about piracy. I guess I imagined you'd be out of the loop, but you know there's a movie.
No, there really is no getting out of the loop, Kathleen,
really?
Unless you really will want to. I mean, I carry a satellite phone that can download Variety magazine if I so choose in the middle of the Ethiopian desert.
Well, whatever you're on right now is pretty amazing because we're hearing you loud and clear. I can't believe you're doing this for 7 years. Do you ever think about the end of this? 7 years is a long time, Paul.
It is and it isn't. The way I look at it is that if I were writing a novel, you know, a good novel, even a bad novel, takes 5 to 7 years of your life. So why undertake a similar literary challenge at sitting down, as it were? Why not do it standing up? So I'm just basically writing a book, actually be writing 2 or 3 books on foot. It's not that long.
Well, I think what you're doing is just wonderful, and thank you so much. It's going to be such a treat to follow your journey because it's so beautifully photographed, and also you're seeing the world from a spiritual level as well and a poetic level, and all of that is good for our souls. Thank you for doing this.
No, it's a shared journey. It's all of ours, and it's a pleasure to share it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. Paul Salopak, our guest, he is walking across the world. You don't say that about too many people who are on the air here. He's just walking across the world. It'll take 7 years. You can please go to our Facebook page because we're linking the National Geographic website and his blog, which is really worth seeing, Out of Eden. It's just there's a lot between his two ears, as you can imagine. So it's all there, and definitely worth seeing. December issue of National Geographic magazine has Our Greatest Journey, One Man, 7 Years, 21,000 Miles. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing the hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley, and thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Robin Cherry as well. Hour 2 coming up.